And let me go to attorney Josh Koskoff. And he is with a fine firm down in Fairfield County, Koskoff, 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 and Beter. Now, which Koskoff am I talking to?
Well, you first of all, you just changed the name of the law firm, but to my benefit.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, there's only two Koskoffs.
There are, but I'm happy to include a third because that would be me if it reached the third generation. But actually, my grandfather was the first Koskoff. My father is the second Koskoff, and I hypothetically would be the third Koskoff.
Well, we've got to get you in there as a partner. I mean, we really do.
Hopefully I can take this as evidence and bring it to the powers that be here.
Well, there's that old Henny Youngman joke, you know, I'd like to speak to, attorney, Richards. And it was Richards, 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 and Richards. And, he's on vacation.
Go.
Oh, I'm sorry, he's retired. Oh, I'm sorry, he blah, blah, blah. And then, I'd like to talk to attorney Richards. Speaking. Well, at any rate, Josh Koskoff, thank you for coming by today. Obviously a serious topic that you wanted to bring to our attention. And I think many people did imagine that we just went through a season when if somebody were contemplating suicide, that might have been the time, the holidays. That's what we've always heard, but there are a lot of, wives and husbands' tales out there. Tell us, you suggest, and you've seen a lot of this in your practice, that the spring is the most, dangerous time, and that we should start looking for signs and trying to help people if we see them in need early on before the spring.
Well, I think the important thing about this whole fallacy of when are people more likely to commit suicide is that the worst thing you can do is base any decision on whether to get help on the time of year. It's not like somebody who's at risk for suicide in the fall is not going to commit suicide because the fall is beautiful, and the converse is also true. The interesting thing is that December, which is some people think the highest month of suicide, is actually the least highest on a national average. But national averages shouldn't weigh into any decisions on an individual basis. So if you're waiting for the weather to get better, to seek help or to have somebody in your family seek help, you are making a very big mistake because the weather has very little to do with suicide. And the truth is that the rates on a national basis do go up in the spring and the fall.
Interesting. Now, when we look at this, of course, here we are in Connecticut. And what we've been focused on, Attorney Koskoff, is how do we even begin to imagine somebody who's got it in their mind to commit a homicide or a mass murder? So that's what we have been focused on, the outward manifestation of someone's inner lack of peace. Let's put it that way. So here we're talking about trying to understand somebody who's tormented that they are thinking about ending their own life, and we find it hard enough to figure out who might take out their aggression against society, let alone against themselves. What are the risk factors, and how do we, as people who care about a lot of folks who may not seem happy with their lot, what do we do?
Okay, it's an excellent question, and very topical, as you stated. And the first thing I would say is that the risk factors for suicide and the risk factors for homicide are almost without exception the same risk factors. And in fact, if you look at the recent massacre at Sandy Hook, it is likely that, it's clear that in addition to being homicidal, Adam Lanza was also suicidal. So that could be looked at as a suicide as well. The risk factors that I've seen most often in my cases, there are different categories. The first would be an underlying psychiatric disorder, so something called major depressive disorder. Now, that's technically different than a garden variety depression, and it has to meet certain criteria. But from the point of view of your listeners or lay people, you're not expected to know the difference between a major depression and a serious depression, let's say. That's the job of the healthcare professional. But these are things that the healthcare professionals look for. Another thing would be substance abuse and anxiety disorders. So those would be underlying conditions that would increase the risk. I think more importantly, as a parent and husband and son, the thing that I've come to find is that in almost all my cases, there has been something that has been a life-changing trigger. For example, almost without exception, I've seen that when that a person who has recently lost a spouse by divorce or a boyfriend or girlfriend by breakup, that these are people who, if they have some type of underlying issue already, are increases the risk of suicide tremendously. I would add to that people who have had recent legal problems, also that jumps up significantly. And finally, I would add people who have had a recent loss of job or financial problems. That's another very well-known risk factor. Of course, when you start combining them, it becomes even more of a concern, which is why when you see a couple going through a divorce where there are both legal problems, the loss of a partner, and often financial problems, it's like a terrible concoction for suicide.
Okay, now let me ask you, what about prior suicide attempts? In other words, you know, we see people who do make the attempt, and I saw it in one case where a child attempted it, and he was, you know, in his teens. And then I know the parents were very watchful. They did just about everything they could to keep him within their sight all the time. But as we know, I mean, that is not practical. And one day he tried again and was successful this time. How much do we see in cases where they are completed suicides that there have been prior suicide attempts?
Well, that's one of the biggest risk factors as well. It's such a big risk factor. I mean, the reason I didn't particularly focus on that is because that's such an that's such a big one.
Sure.
But that there are so many suicides where there was not a prior attempt that it would that you wouldn't want to take lightly a situation where a person didn't have a prior attempt. But that is considered one of the biggest red flags. Probably makes a lot of sense to people why that would be a matter of great concern. And, you know, the thing that the public needs to know is that these risk factors that would cause somebody to attempt a suicide first and complete one first or second, these are treatable risk factors. But just like you wouldn't try to treat your heart condition by yourself without seeing a doctor, the same should be true for treating these risk factors. So there's still a public bias that tends against seeking mental health care. But these people are trained to address, treat, identify risk factors and prevent suicides. So that we have to get over as a public the bias that whereas we would go to a doctor for a heart condition, we would not go to seek health treatment for somebody we love or for ourselves.
What about family history of suicide? How much does that enter into it?
Well, that's another strong correlative issue. So that if you have a family history of suicide, it is thought to be genetic, probably not the suicide itself, mm-hmm. but whatever the underlying condition is that caused somebody to take their life. So if somebody has a history of depression, that's considered to be passed on genetically. Again, it's not exclusive, but that's something that is carefully looked at.
Okay, if you have any questions for us on this topic, 203-757-1320, somebody might ask, you know, Josh Koskoff, attorney of Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter, how often you see these issues, and as an attorney, what, you know, do you kind of get involved with as it relates to this? Obviously, there's a lot that has to be cleaned up afterwards legally, you know, unfortunately, but what do you see in your practice? I mean, and how often do these issues have come to the fore?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't set out to focus at all on suicide cases, but I found that we were seeing more and more of them as the public begins to become aware that there is treatment for conditions that lead to suicide. And so the issues that have come up, and they're somewhat varied, but they usually have consistent factors. I've seen cases where emergency rooms have discharged the patient, when they shouldn't have, and the patient has subsequently committed suicide in the immediate time frame after discharge. That's a common case, and that usually, when you look at the records and you do your depositions, you find out all of the communication holes that occurred in that emergency room. The premise of any emergency room ought to be, when there's any doubt about a patient's safety, they ought to admit, and most people would agree with that. So that's one area where I see a lot of problems. And, you know, to handle a lot of these cases, it's discouraging, because the goal would be not just to bring some peace to the family that you represent, but also hopefully to effect some change. And hopefully over time, we all know that lawsuits help to make changes in healthcare or product safety, and so that would be the goal.
But let me ask you, how much do we hold society or an institution, a hospital, whatever, liable for a suicide because they didn't see something or they didn't react in a particular way, as opposed to us still, you know, looking at it and saying, well, this was a troubled soul and it's unfortunate, but it was something really personal and not institutionalized? I mean, how often do we see that liability, you know, kind of pushed over to another institution, if you will?
Well, I think that is a really perceptive question, and it goes back to that bias that we have, where we see doctors as being able to treat us for conditions that might cause a heart attack, let's say, you know, high cholesterol, stress, not enough exercise, whatever. And we will hold doctors accountable in that scenario. And so even though suicide is slightly more complicated in that it involves an act that a person does to him or herself, to get to that point, you have to cross a lot of treatable conditions that may not go treated. So if those don't get treated, then it's not an excuse for the ER, let's say, which usually has a crisis center staffed of professionals whose only job it is to determine whether it's safe to send a patient home or whether they need further psychiatric care. And that's what they charge for, and that's why you bring patients to the ER. So if you do that, and through bad communication, poor history taking, whatever, they discharge a patient, the fact that the patient goes out and commits suicide is the thing that they're charged to prevent.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, I think, in many ways. But, you know, even when we get back to the physical concerns, for example, if a doctor says, well, you've got high cholesterol, and I decide to keep eating, you know, Twinkies, if they were still on the market, and not taking my meds, you know, I mean, right. Whose responsibility? I mean, there's a whole lot that gets tangled up in this. But let me ask you, I mean, we're all hearing about teenage suicides, and, of course, we're also hearing of suicides of those who come back and having served us in the military and tormented by what they've seen there. But are we, when we think of teenage suicide as opposed to an older age, are we skewing this whole picture again, or is that realistic that there are more teens as their whole, you know, time of life is in flux? We know what a confusing time teenage life can be and how difficult our peers can be on us and how diminished we can feel in the context of what it is that they tell us about ourselves as we're still trying to figure ourselves out. The question really is it really more predominant among teenagers or no?
Well, it depends on how you look at the statistics. Statistically, it would be the third leading cause of death for people ages 15 to 24. And for the age category below that, it's the fourth leading cause of death. I don't have the numbers as a percentage of 100,000 teens. How does that compare to as a percentage of 100,000 adults? But I think it's fair to say that it's a matter of great concern for parents and school systems and the teenage community. And I think it might be helpful just to there are a couple things that I see in the teenage cases. Obviously, you have the breakups that can cause a lot of anxiety, especially that first breakup where you've invested, you've had your heart broken. We've all had that experience. Mm-hmm. To some extent, but if you have that alone can be so significant that it causes you to think about suicide. If that's on top of other issues, you know, if you don't have a stable family life, if you're generally isolated, you don't have a strong group of friends, and the things to look for as parents would be, has my child suddenly become withdrawn? Have they suddenly changed their habits? Are they no longer eating? Insomnia is a huge risk factor that I've seen, because it not only is it a sign that you're deeply troubled, but also when you're extremely tired, your ability to make good decisions starts to go away. So if you see a sudden change in your child's health, or rather their disposition, and that's usually something that needs to be looked at. And as a parent, you have to remember there are limitations in what you can do. Oftentimes, when I'm dealing with parents in these cases, they say to me things like, you know, we never saw this coming. She seems so happy. And a lot of times, that's part of the problem, is that the child does not want to bring the parent into their emotional struggles. And that's natural, but you just have to know your limitations, and that's when, in particular, you really need to seek help.
Okay, well, we know there's a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK, which is 8255, 1-800-273-TALK. Anything else that we could leave for our audience to consider? Look, we're all in contact with people of all ages who have all kinds of issues that they're struggling with, and, you know, we don't want to, you know, blow this out of proportion. However, if you really see somebody cascading into a very dark place, you want to be able to, you know, try to help. What can we do?
Well, there's one thing I want to mention that is topical and really important, and that is if you have firearms in the house and somebody is going through a divorce, depressed, emotional turbulence, those firearms need to either be removed or locked up by somebody who is not going through that. Because there are 19,000 plus suicides a year by firearm. So, you know, in this time period where we're all become more aware about gun violence, and right, understandably focused on the homicide aspects, it's actually suicides that cause more death by firearm than homicides. And the gun is the difference maker in a lot of these cases, where if you didn't have a gun and you had to percolate on the act of suicide, there would be far fewer suicides.
Yeah,
there's a tension there.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was reading where 56% of the males, and males, of course, this is the seventh leading cause of death and 15th among females in the last material that I could find, and 56% of those done by males were by firearms, 30% for females. The next was suffocation, 24% by males, 21% by females, and poisoning, 13% by males, 40% by females. So interesting differential there. Listen, I want to thank you so much, Josh Koskoff from Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter, for being with us today to talk about a very tough subject here, but I do thank you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's now 12 minutes before 11 o'clock on